This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is another podcast of Worldwide Wave, the international LGBT news and current affairs show, every week on Australia's first LGBT radio station, Joy 94.9.
Surfing the globe, bringing you news, views, and current affairs for the LGBT community, this is the Worldwide Wave.
This is Worldwide Wave, Joy's international news and current affairs show for and by the LGBTI community. We take you around the globe, one queer story at a time. I'm Matt, and spaced out appropriately across Melbourne and dialing in remotely to be with you tonight, I'm joined on the Worldwide Wave panel by Shannon.
Hey.
And Stefan.
Hello. It's Trans Awareness Week, a chance to celebrate trans people, educate and take action to support our trans communities. Over the years, Worldwide Wave has spoken with some incredible trans leaders from across the globe. Tonight, we showcase some of their amazing, inspiring stories.
We'll bring you interviews from some of the outstanding global trans leaders, including India's first elected trans politician, Apsara Reddy, Imani De Silva, a trans activist leading the charge for change in the Central African country of Angola, the USA's first trans senator, Senator-elect Sarah McBride, and we speak with the author of the latest global snapshot of trans rights, Zan Cheam.
Receive LGBT news from around the world throughout the week. Like Worldwide Wave on Facebook now.
It was only a few years ago that homosexuality was still illegal under colonial-era sodomy laws. Now the Indian Parliament is discussing a bill to give rights and protections to its transgender community. There is no person better qualified to speak about this topic than Apsara Reddy, the first transgender politician in the Indian National Congress Party. Apsara now spends her time working with the All India Mahila Congress, the women's wing of the Indian National Congress, one of the largest political parties in the country. We asked her how she found her way into politics and her opinion about the controversial Transgender Protection Bill.
I was a trained journalist. I worked with organisations like the BBC. I worked with organisations in Australia, in India, national dailies, English dailies. I never really planned politics. For me, journalism happened, and from journalism, I was invited by a really big network in India to do a television chat show with celebrities. And I think I did that. And then I was spotted by various powerful politicians and offered roles in political parties, which I, you know, I became the official national official spokesperson for English media for a channel, which was for a political party in Tamil Nadu, in the south of India. And further to that, I was elevated, you know, into the Indian National Congress, which is one of the largest and oldest party, political party in India. And I represent the women's division. So I'm really, really happy that mainstreaming has happened for me. I'm considered a woman now. I represent gender justice issues, you know, across platforms. I even address the European Parliament as a spokesperson. So I think it's been a great journey, and I think being in politics is a great platform, not just to just have a voice, but also visibility of a trans woman in politics changes so much perspective.
What was interesting to note is that your first party was the BJP, and given some of their very conservative outlooks, how was this your first step into politics?
See, as I told you, I never planned my entry into politics. Yeah. I was invited for a Women's Day function on March 8th, International Women's Day, to receive an award at the local BJP office in my state. And then when I went there, they said, hey, listen, why don't you head the women's wing in the state? And I said, I'll think about it. Even before I did any paperwork, before I got the identity card, before I got any membership number, the media splashed the news that I was part of the BJP. I was never really part of the BJP. I just had lunch with the leaders and received an award.
Okay.
So what's been reported in the media is completely false, because I was never a member of the BJP. Of course, I met the leaders. I had lunch with them. I had you know, the most powerful leaders of the party took me out for lunch and gave me an award. But it was just an award.
Yeah. While on the topic of the BJP, would you like to move on to the our next hot topic in India, the transgender person's protection bill?
I have huge issues with that. I really think they grossly, it's obviously not, the amended bill is not yet passed. I mean, we've asked for amendments and the final bill is not yet out and not been presented, but the initial bill that the BJP authored was grossly in violation of human rights and dignity. They basically criminalized so many things that a transgender woman does. For example, living arrangements. And transgender women are not, you know, there are no reservations in jobs or medical subsidies or housing. And when transgender women are thrown out of home in India, they have no place to go, but other transgender women take them in and groom them. So that was being criminalized. There was also begging was being criminalized. And, you know, they beg out of joblessness. They beg because of unemployment, because of hunger, not because anybody likes to get on the streets and beg for money. But transgender women are pushed to a corner without opportunity. So I feel without the government talking about opportunity or reservations in, you know, in housing, in education, in medical facilities, how can then, how then can transgender women, you know, have a dignified life? They're thrown out of home. They're left to fend for themselves on the street. There's huge sexual violence. So I really feel a transgender bill should talk about protecting transgender women and opportunities before criminalizing their lifestyle. And also, the Supreme Court of India has said that self-identification is very, very important to human dignity. So if I identify as a trans woman, I deserve to be known as a trans woman and I need to have my identity card made that way. But unfortunately, the BJP says you have to go in front of, the government says, the national government says, that you have to go in front of a screening committee which determines whether you're good enough to be a woman or a man or a transgender. And I feel that is really in violation of the judgment of the Supreme Court, which says self-identification should be supreme.
Is there any chance there's going to be self-affirmation in the Indian law? Is that an amendment that's at all possible, or is that for a future date?
The Supreme Court has already said that self-identification should be the priority, and that's the way forward. But the government in Parliament is still deliberating a very archaic transgender bill, which basically wants a transgender individual to face a district screening committee. So in every district of your state, you have to go to a screening committee where there's a panel of people who examine you. And I feel that's grossly in violation of human dignity, because I think I'm allowed to choose who I am and who I want to be. And I think that shouldn't be left for a future date, but unfortunately, the way the Indian government is dragging its feet on it, one can only wait and watch what the Indian government does in terms of self-identification, self-affirmation. It's absolutely in violation of human dignity.
Yes, absolutely.
Could you just spell out maybe one or two specific concerns within the LGBTI community that they have against the bill?
One is the transgender bill basically criminalizes a bunch of transgender women staying together. I don't think they can enter into family arrangements with any other couple, but when it comes to transgender, any families, but when it comes to transgender women, when they live with like three other or four other transgender women, they criminalize that. They say the transgender women have to live with families, and if the families do not accept them, they have to live in care centers provided by the government, which are basically like dungeons, which I think is unfair. I think adults should be able to choose their own living arrangement. I hope that is being amended in the fresh bill that they're going to present in Parliament. The other thing that I have a concern with is when they criminalize begging, when they say transgender women cannot, you know, of course, there's a lot of transgender begging, and I know it is a nuisance in a lot of cases, like on public trains and wherever else, but they have no other choice because people don't give them homes to live in. People don't give them homes on rent. They don't have any facilities to educate themselves and access jobs. And they're thrown out of home. So what do? They're prone to sexual violence and they have to feed themselves. So they ask for, you know, charity. I really feel that has to change with opportunity and not by criminalizing begging. I think we have to give them opportunity to transform their lives.
And I was just going through the bill and I found there was a specific section where it says, if you want a gender certificate, which is based on the gender you identify, you need to have had surgery and then like a medical certificate and someone else who also confirms that all those details are right. Do you think personally that there should be a law regarding that? Like should it require for them to
have a very different... there might be technical reasons to why the bill is asking for that, but my view as being a member of the community is that when you are a transgender person in transition, it takes a long time for you to do your hormones, do your surgery when you're ready for it. But from day one that you pop that pill and you identify as a woman or a trans woman or a trans man, you need to be given the dignity of the gender you choose. Mm-hmm. I feel for them to say, you know, you go through that 5 years of hormones and you go through that, you know, another 5 years of your surgery and then looking convincing enough and having all the anatomy, right? And that's when I will determine if you're good enough or not. I feel that's not self-affirmation, right?
Yeah.
Look, so if there's a young boy who identifies as transgender and starts his hormones, it takes quite a while for them to get to the stage of surgery. But you can't wait till that time to kind of tell him that you're a trans woman. Mm. He feels that way from day one, and that's something which is such a powerful internal emotion which you cannot deny.
That was India's first elected trans politician, Apsara Reddy, with us on Joy. Coming up, we review the largest report on global trans rights. You're on the World Wide Wave.
Hello, Australia. This is Noam Apple and Top from Apple Models in Thailand. The world's first transgender model division on Joy 94.9.
We love receiving your messages, and even though we're broadcasting outside the studios, you can still message us. We are on Facebook. It's World Wide Wave or W3Joy.
Since 2016... ILGA, the International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans and Intersex Association, has published a trans legal mapping report. The report gives a very detailed account on the impacts of laws and policies on trans persons in 143 UN member states. The 2020 report is the third edition. Trans leader Zahn Chiam is co-author of ILGA World's Trans Legal Mapping Report. Zahn was the coordinator of ILGA World's Gender Identity and Expression Program and also serves on advisory committees for the Asia Pacific Transgender Network and Transgender Europe's TVT project. Zahn explains how the report came about.
I mean, ILGA is an organization that's a global membership organization, so it's the only global federation of LGBTI organizations worldwide. And so it always has had an interest in publishing global reports. It's published a state-sponsored homophobia report for the last 13 years, I believe. And that's an overview of laws as they relate to same-sex behavior, including criminalization around the world. So when I started the Gender Identity Expression Program in 2014 at ILGA, there was already an interest from the membership, the trans membership, for there to be a similar report coming out of ILGA on issues that related to trans people. At the time, TGEU, Transgender Europe, was putting out a global mapping of an overview of lived experiences of trans people around the world, but it wasn't from a legal point of view. So it was very much from the social perspective. And of course that touches upon legal issues, but it didn't take that exact approach. So so in 2016, we decided to compile the first edition, and it turned out to be useful. So the feedback we got was that it was useful. We also worked together with Transgender Europe to make sure that, you know, information was complementary. And so we continue with it, yeah.
And Zahn, you've now put out the third edition of the Transgender Legal Mapping Report. Tell us, is life getting better for trans communities?
You know, I wish that after three editions, I wish I had asked myself that question first, because everyone seems to ask that question. And I think we get a bit lost in the data, and then we forget that maybe that's what people want to know. I have to say that the angle through which we do the research makes it quite difficult to answer the question. So we look at it from the point of view of what do the laws say, and how, you know, the nuance of legal gender recognition. So in all three editions, the one constant has been legal gender recognition, which is the ability of people to change their name or gender markers in a certain jurisdiction. So whether that's by policy or administrative process or by law. And that is one window through which you look at the life, how the life of a person is affected, right? And it's quite hard to tell, just looking at that, necessarily what the situation is. So, for example, if you have a country that has a really fantastic legal gender recognition process, like say Argentina or Malta, or a lot more of the European countries that have followed, then you could probably say that life is easier and better on the face of it for most trans people in that country. But it doesn't mean that criminalization of them doesn't exist, or it doesn't mean that, you know, trans people, because of a legal gender recognition process, are more likely to have gainful employment or anything like that. It's a good indicator, but it doesn't tell you the whole picture. But if you flip it on the other side, if you have a country where there is no legal gender recognition process, then it doesn't necessarily mean that that process isn't available in some way. And it doesn't mean that people can't access identity documents if they tried in a way that isn't official. It just means that it's under the table in that sense. So it's really hard to tell. In this edition, we decided to cover criminalization examples, and criminalization we've called indirect or direct, so either de facto or de jure criminalization. And for that, you get a bit more of a picture of how authorities act with impunity against trans people. So that gives you another side of the equation. But if you think of it holistically, it is really hard to then say, you know, this country is really great and trans people should try and live there, and this country isn't.
Have you found some countries that are exemplary? And if you have, to know why?
Again, if you just look at legal gender recognition, which is what the report is largely about. So Argentina has a really great model. So it was the first in the world in 2012 that allowed legal gender recognition through a self-identification model or self-determination model, which means that a person can self-declare that their gender is what they say it is, and then have their identity documents changed in the process. Their legal gender recognition law also allows for access to healthcare for trans people, which you know, is at the time was also very forward thinking. Malta followed suit, and the Maltese government has followed up with a series of initiatives to kind of roll out and to look at what you know, legal gender recognition was like for people in schools and in public services. So that's also exemplary in that sense. Then you have a lot of Latin American countries which have really great laws, or have developed and passed really great laws for trans people. And this includes trans children. It includes the ability to, in the case of, for example, Costa Rica, they now have a model where you don't even have to have a person's gender on any state-issued document. So you can have your gender removed from your birth certificate. Chile just went through a lengthy process and was able to have a legal gender recognition process. So on the face of it, you know, Latin America as a block has very good laws in place. But then if you look at the criminalization section for these countries, you see also that there are numerous reported cases of quite severe violence and discrimination that people face, and very often at the hands of police and other authority figures, using a whole bunch of laws, laws relating to sex work, laws relating to drugs, vagrancy, loitering, beggary, and in detention settings. So those two things exist, you know, in the same countries.
That was Dan Chiam, co-author of Trans Legal Mapping Report by ILGA World on Joy 94.9. Coming up, some good news from the trans community in Africa.
And hello to all of those listening to us on podcast. You can subscribe to receive our podcast automatically, either at joy.org.au/worldwidewave, or on iTunes or any of your favourite podcast platforms.
Joy 94.9 is Australia's only LGBTQIA+ community radio station.
Community radio stations are run entirely on the support of our listener business and organisation members and donors, which means we can't keep broadcasting amazing rainbow content without your help. That's right, you. You can support Joy by becoming a full member, donate monthly via our subscription service, or make a one-off donation.
Any amount helps. Help keep rainbow independent voices on air.
Head to joy.org.au/members for more information.
Kia ora, my name is Tatriana and I'm from the Cook Islands LGBT organisation, BTLA Association, on the World Wide Web.
It's Trans Awareness Week and we are showcasing some of the greatest trans leaders from across the globe. It is quite rare that we're able to bring you good news stories about LGBTI rights from Africa. But in the west of Central Africa is a country, after centuries of Portuguese colonization, that has set about not just removing colonial sodomy law, but bringing new laws to protect the LGBTI community against discrimination. Imani da Silva is an independent trans activist from Angola. We ask Imani how this came about and how long they have been fighting for this change.
That international media has been more participative than the national media. I think that it's something that people are, you know, obviously, you know, every single newspaper and on TV, they have mentioned it. But even though there is no such a big thing about it through the media, even though we have for, let's say, for the past few years, I myself, we have been just having this exchange of ideas with the media, they've always been extremely interested in what it's all about to be an LGBT in the country. And yeah, we've been informing and sharing our own experiences. I think that we just, basically the media is just waiting for what's coming next.
And this change to the law, how do you think it might affect the daily lives of LGBT people in Angola?
Oh, it will change things immensely. Why? Because now, one thing that we believe that is extremely important is to address homophobia, because it's something that, you know, even in the past, people who were victims of homophobia, it was never, that word was never mentioned as the reason why that person was attacked or that person was killed, even though there is no record of how many crimes related to homophobia. But obviously there is crimes that happen daily. The LGBT community faces discrimination, even inside their homes, which is even more more scary. And it's something that we have to address as well. But the fact that the government is recognizing that there is crimes against LGBT community, it's a great deal for us. And we know that in the near future, when we know that we are victims and we can prove that we are victims, we can actually present that to the to a lawyer. We can go to the to court. In fact, actually, they've just mentioned that if a person denies job to a person to another person because of their sexual orientation, they can be jailed for up to 2 years. So we are seeing the change, and because it's so recent, we believe that within 1 year there is so much more that the government will implement in terms of our rights.
It's very exciting. You touched a little there on what life is like for an LGBT person in Angola. Tell us a bit more about that and how somebody who is gay or bi or trans is seen within their family.
You know, as an African country, for cultural reasons, there's a lot of sexism and, you know, it's seen in African culture in general as, for example, the male, you know, he needs to be portrayed in a certain way. And when you actually go against all this, those cultural and social rules, obviously you have consequences. Obviously, I live in the capital city, which is slightly more modern, and it's like most of the cities in the country. And obviously, as a nation, we kind of more easily absorb what's different and we tend to try to understand what's different. Obviously, I cannot say that there is no negativity. Of course, there is. It's a challenge daily. For example, me as a transsexual, I managed to reach a point, you know, where I can use my own experience not only to empower the community, but also to re-educate society in general. So being transsexual and to have worked on TV, to work in the model industry, to be able to be a contemporary artist that has been recognized for my work, it's something that I use to actually empower other members of the community that we can be whatever we want to be. We can do whatever we want to do, and also show the society in general that we're not useless. We are not ill. There's no such thing as an illness. We are normal people that have the same right as anyone else.
When there are those instances of homophobia or transphobia, does it generally get to the point of violence, or is it more subtle than that?
It's much more subtle. I mean, 20 years ago, you know, as a teenager, it was completely different. I normally used to joke in a sort of way with the youngest members of the LGBT community, and I say, my God, I just wish I was a teenager today, because it's so much easier. There is so much more understanding. There is much more visibility. Obviously, I think that just like any other country in the world, one of the biggest tools for people to bully, it's online. You know, people use social media to bully, and that's something that, you know, it's quite hard. It's stronger because it's harder to control. But in general, there is less violence, I would say, to the point of even physical violence compared to a couple of decades ago. But still is. We cannot hide and say there isn't. Yes, there still is, especially those who live in the, you know, the ones who are poorer, they're the ones who face the biggest challenges. Most of them have been kicked out of their homes, and they have no other choice but to sell their bodies or to do other things that are considered unlawful. So it's something that is extremely important to address, because we want them to have, just like any other young person, to be able to get an education, to be able to be well received when they go to have medical assistance. And these are the places where they face a lot of discrimination.
What about a sense of community, as in the LGBT community? Is there a sense, a common place, a way that you connect with other LGBT people?
Yes, I feel that there is. It was just like about 3 weeks ago that the association Iris invited me for a workshop, and you could tell that how much they want to listen and how much they want to be guided, even through social media, the amount of messages, you know, because we are aware that together we are stronger, and we are aware that it doesn't matter how different we might be from one another, we all have something in common. And that is the main reason why we keep holding each other's hands. And that's what sustains the community, especially the younger ones.
From Angola, that's independent trans activist Imani Da Silva on Joy 94.9. Coming up, we speak with the first trans senator elected in the United States, Sarah McBride. This is Worldwide Wave.
Hi, this is Taya Braun from the Human Dignity Trust. We use the law to defend the human rights of LGBT people globally, and we love the support in sharing our message on Worldwide Wave.
Trans rights have taken a battering under President Donald Trump. But the recent election created the first transgender state senator in the US, Sarah McBride. She won her race in the small US state of Delaware. Senator-elect Sarah McBride is no stranger to advocacy, having served as the National Press Secretary for activist group The Human Rights Campaign. She is an activist who came out as a transgender woman while president of her university student body. She's worked inside politics, including as a White House intern during Barack Obama's term, and continues to drive change for LGBTI Americans. She came into the Joy Studios on a visit to Melbourne before she began her successful campaign.
It was at the Democratic Convention, and you were the first transgender woman to speak at the Democratic Convention, which endorsed Hillary Clinton. That really put you on the stage. You know, everyone tweeted that, everybody watched that. What was life like after that? Was that a pivotal point? Am I right in thinking that was one of the things? It was the day before and the day after was different?
Yeah. It's funny you mention that, because the day after, I was driving with my mom and we went out to get Italian water ice in the middle of the day. It was summer of 2016. And I said, it feels so normal right now, but it also feels like everything's completely changed. Having the opportunity to speak at the Democratic National Convention was the greatest professional opportunity and responsibility of my life. It was really powerful to be in that arena, to watch an arena full of people applaud and cheer not my dignity, not my story, but the dignity and the stories and the rights of transgender people across the United States. And that was really, for so many transgender people, the first time we saw politics, which unfortunately, historically, is a cautious field, so clearly embrace our lives and our cause. And from that day on, I've had the opportunity to have my voice heard in big and small ways in the movement for equality in the United States, and to travel around the United States and increasingly the world talking about this.
So when you do become a public figure in 2019 and for several years now in social media, you're very exposed. What strategies do you have to deal with the hate and the abuse that inevitably comes with being in that public position? How do you mentally cope with that?
That's a really great question. And I think it's a question, it's one of the most significant questions we have, is how do we leverage the positive aspects of social media and the digital age where we have democratized the microphone? How do we as a society make sure that we're ensuring that that's allowing for diverse and marginalized voices to be heard, and not just the overcrowding of those spaces into the comment sections of basically Fox News in the United States? And that's a big question for our society. But for me, in dealing with that hate and the bullying that I've seen online, I think I try to remember two different things. The first is that the glimpse that I have on my social media into that bullying is just a tiny reflection of what particularly LGBTQ young people are facing every single day. The second lesson I try to remember is one that I learned in probably the worst experience of online harassment that I had. And in 2016, before the convention, I took a selfie of myself in a bathroom in North Carolina that I was legally barred from being in after the North Carolina legislature had passed HB2. And the post and the picture quickly went viral, and the responses that came in at first were incredibly positive, but then the more it spread across the internet, the more the responses were incredibly hateful. I mean, from threats of murder and sexual assault to the most common comment, which was three letters over and over again, KYS, 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 kill yourself, kill yourself, kill yourself, over and over again. And I was 25 at the time. I didn't think words on a screen could impact me as much, but it was the only period in time in my life where suicide became even a rational thought, because it was just so overwhelming. And even though I knew the news cycle would dissipate, I still just wanted out of it so badly. And after it finally did dissipate, I wondered, can I do this work? Can I be public as a transgender person in any kind of occupation? Because this is the inevitable byproduct, and I don't know if I have thick enough skin. And so I spent a lot of time reflecting and reading and listening to a lot of other folks who experience online harassment. And I came across an interview with a reporter who writes a lot about body positivity and her weight. Mm-hmm. And there was an interview with her that really helped to shift my perspective and help me deal a little bit more with the online harassment. And the lesson I took from it, which is that so often we say that the biggest bullies are oftentimes the biggest closet cases. And that might be true in certain instances, but it undervalues and diminishes a more universal truth, which is that everyone has an insecurity, whether it's their sexual orientation or their gender identity or how they look, what they do, how they sound, where they come from. No matter what it is, everyone has something that society says they that society has said they should be ashamed of or tried to hide. And the thing about LGBTQ people is that we have taken that fact. We have taken our insecurities. We have taken our biggest fears. And we've not only accepted them, but oftentimes we walk forward from a place of pride in them. And the bullies see that power. They see that individual agency in conquering our own fears, and they're jealous of it. And that was something that I needed to learn in order to be able to put 2 feet in front of the others and in order to continue to do this work, to recognize that the hate that comes my way, it's because I'm powerful.
Yes, so you are press secretary with Human Rights Campaign. Tell me a bit about what that organization does and what your priorities are and how you're making a difference.
Sure. So the Human Rights Campaign is the United States' largest LGBTQ civil rights organization. And we work to move equality forward at the local, state, and federal level with our legislative advocacy work, with our electoral work. We work to move LGBTQ inclusive policies forward in businesses and workplaces, in faith communities, in hospitals, in child welfare agencies across the United States. And we've got a global program that works with activists and advocates around the world to bring them together, to use the convening power of our organization to help leverage best practices and support activists around the world doing hard work in places not just like the United States or Australia, but in countries where LGBTQ identities may still be criminalized, where LGBTQ people may still face the death penalty for their identities. It's a great place to work. My colleagues are incredible, a diverse reflection of the community that we seek to advocate for and advocate with. And I'm blessed every single day to have that job.
And clearly, you're very talented to do it. We have, week after week, stories of countries around the world with the sort of human rights issues that you're talking about. And we question, as a group of people on that show, as to what the response should be. And one of the responses might be that we boycott the country or we take some action against it. But what, in your experience, you're saying that the Human Rights Campaign works overseas. What are the tactics, what are the approaches that you think are effective and that you would recommend that we're more widely aware of? Because it seems quite limited sometimes what we think of as... We thought about Bahrain, about Brunei recently. Mm-hmm. And there was a big call there to boycott. But we also heard from some academics that perhaps that wasn't the approach to take. So how do you go about making a difference overseas?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things that we try to be exceptionally aware of, particularly as an organization in the United States, is sometimes the counterproductive hand of either the U.S. government or U.S.-based organizations in trying to push forward change in countries and cultures that are very different than our own, particularly given the power of the United States and the role that it plays in the world. So we seek to make sure that we are, in our work, empowering the advocates and activists on the ground. Because the reality is that there are activists and advocates in every country around this world, even in countries where LGBTQ identities and organizing is totally criminalized. And for us, it's incredibly important that, you know, we don't shut off our ability to support LGBTQ or LGBTI activists in other countries, that we go where the need is. I mean, firefighters run into the building when it's burning. They don't run away from it. And I think that's so important in so much of what we do. Now, there are conversations around boycotts. There's conversations around, you know, international institutions or governments issuing sanctions when there's human rights violations. I think, you know, you have to be very careful when we're talking about that those actions and those activities don't unintentionally harm the very people who are being discriminated against or being killed or facing the persecution. And so it varies based, I think, on the country in terms of, or the circumstance in terms of what the answer is going to specifically be and how the world responds to injustice. But from our perspective in our work, we seek to try to make sure that whether you're an LGBTQ or LGBTI activist in Africa or South America or Asia or Europe, that you're getting support from us no matter the circumstances that you find yourself in.
Senator-elect Sarah McBride, the first trans senator in the United States, speaking with us on Joy 94.9.
Receive LGBT news from around the world throughout the week. Like World Wide Wave on Facebook now.
A big thank you to our wonderful trans leaders tonight. India's first elected trans politician, Apsara Reddy, co-author of ILGA World's Trans Legal Mapping Report, Zan Chiam, Imani Da Silva, a trans activist in Angola, and Senator-elect Sarah McBride in the USA. Now, they're just a taste of the full interviews. You can hear the whole interview on our podcast. Go to joy.org.au/worldwidewave or subscribe at your favourite podcast platform.
And thank you to all those who have got in touch with us on Facebook, Milo, Hope, Stephen, Liz, Josh, and a heap more who have joined or interacted with us on Facebook this past week. For those who want to get in touch, that's W3Joy on Facebook.
And a huge thank you to people behind the scene, and that's our podcaster, Peter, and our social media master, Dean.
Thanks for listening to another podcast from World Wide Wave, the show that takes you around the globe one country at a time. World Wide Wave is the international news and current affairs show on Australia's LGBT radio station, Joy 94.9. You can listen live every Tuesday night from 7 p.m. Eastern Australian Time on 94.9 FM in Melbourne and online at joy.org.au. You'll find all our podcasts at joy.org.au/worldwidewave or follow us on Facebook for the latest international LGBT news. Search W3Joy on Facebook now.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.